Canadians and Americans, especially those who live close to the border, have kind of taken for granted that we are almost the same country, which we're not, obviously. But it's, I think it's a good thing that we have felt that way. And therefore, having those restrictions in place, which were necessary for the protection of our people, were very difficult. COVID was difficult for everybody in all kinds of ways. And people suffered loss and they weren't able to see their families for a very long time and their friends and do the normal things that we all like to do. But I think for border communities, it was particularly difficult. Do I think it has a lasting impact? Look, I'm not seeing it. What I'm actually seeing, and there are many, like Hyder Stewart here in Alaska was particularly difficult. There are about over a dozen communities like Hyder Stewart across the country where people daily would go back and forth to doctors and grocery stores and schools. And what I've seen is those communities have completely re-embraced each other, right? And rather than having a long-term effect, I think it's more like a incredible, joyous family reunion, which I'm very pleased at. But we shouldn't take it for granted. We shouldn't take that closeness for granted. We should make sure we're nurturing it all the time.
It kind of strikes me as something that we took for granted and that we maybe appreciate more now that things are coming back to normal.
I hope so. And I think we learned. We learned, you know, as one always does in a difficult situation, we learned about how to do things better between our two countries, about certain kinds of, you know, government procedures that could be simpler and will be going forward. So that's important as well. I have to make sure that we take away from this all of the good things or as many good things as we can.
I imagine in your discussions with the symposium that you're here visiting for, that maybe Russia comes up from time to time. And so maybe this is an obvious question, but are you, as Canada's ambassador, are you concerned about Russia's expansion in the Arctic, whether that's with natural resource development or militarily? And what are those conversations like that you're having?
Yeah. So, I mean, first, just to state it very plainly, just like the United States, Canada condemns Russia's invasion of Ukraine in the strongest possible terms. It is completely unjustified, and frankly, the images we see are unimaginable, the horrors. In terms of our here at the conference, you know, it's the circumpolar nations minus Russia, because Russia isn't here. One of the things that's very clear about the way in which our nations work together, in particular in the North and the circumpolar region, is that a lot of what we do for the benefit of our communities is through cooperative action, whether that's data gathering, whether that's search and rescue, whether that's defense. We are a community of nations that are inhabiting this very special part of the globe. And the fact that now we are not able to have any real cooperation with Russia, and we'll see, you know, if and when that will pick up again, is obviously very unfortunate. But there is also a deep commitment and recognition amongst the countries here and amongst the communities, because there are many of the Indigenous and other communities represented at the conference, to make sure that we continue the work despite these challenges, and in fact probably makes it even more important for us to be, you know, countries of similar values, countries that recognize the rule of law and have our interactions with our neighbors completely underpinned by respecting the rule of law and territorial sovereignty of each other. We need to be making sure that we solidify those bonds in this particular moment.
I wonder, too, if you could kind of describe the relationship between the United States and Canada in terms of defense, and that we do share the Arctic with Russia, which has, like you said, had this pretty unjustified invasion of Ukraine. What is that like these days?
Yeah, so Canada and the U.S., President Biden and Prime Minister Trudeau, back in November of 2021, and then again recently, have sort of reconfirmed, doubled down on our commitment to continental defense. So to defend the North American continent, to modernize NORAD, which plays a very important role in the North, and to look specifically at Arctic defense. In fact, our budget came out today, and there is there has been funding put towards that modernization already, but there is more emphasis on modernization of NORAD and continental defense. So we are making some very concrete and deliberate choices, speaking for Canada, to make sure that we have the tools and resources in place to protect ourselves in the North, to make sure that we are asserting our sovereignty in the North. I mean, I don't think anybody is of the view that there's going to be an invasion by Russia in the North, but we do need to make sure that it's clear that we will and can defend ourselves, and we're willing to do so.
Yeah. Obviously, another problem that we're all facing in the North is climate change. Are there specific initiatives between the United States and Canada that you've been working on that help us deal with climate change?
So, yes, we have. I would say the way in which we organize ourselves on the climate change file between Canada and the U.S. is sort of twofold. There are domestic-focused things that we are doing in our own countries in support of each other and in support of our own domestic agendas, and then we work in concert together on the international stage. So on the international stage, what we seek to do is work together to raise the ambitions of other countries, in particular the biggest emitters, to reduce their emissions and to bring themselves towards energy transition. In Canada and in the United States, we have a very close alignment in the kinds of policies that we are trying to advance domestically. So, for example, we are both pursuing an aggressive electrification of our transportation sector because our transportation sector is one of the biggest emitters overall in our countries. We are both Canada has just put in place emissions controls for natural gas and oil and gas. Those are also, you know, something that the U.S. is working on. We are trying to accelerate the transition away from fossil fuels to cleaner energy sources, recognizing that that's not going to happen overnight. We are also working really hard in making the fossil fuel industry as innovative, as clean, as non-emitting as possible. And frankly, we are doing a very good job. I speak for Canada here. I think that our sector is deeply committed to technologies that make them, you know, the best gold standard across the world. So we are working in a variety of different ways with the Americans, beside them, you know, just depending on the context.
Gotcha. Yeah. I read in your bio that you had done a lot of work, I think as a deputy ambassador, right, to modernize NAFTA. And because I'm pretty naive about all these things, I just wondered, what does that mean in the grand scheme of NAFTA to modernize it?
So the NAFTA was concluded in 1994, and it essentially led to complete sort of tariff-free trade between Canada, U.S., and Mexico. Not completely, but largely. But because it was concluded in 1994, there are many things that were in that agreement that were a little antiquated. Procedures around, like, customs processes that were negotiated at a time when there was no internet, there was no e-commerce, there was no Amazon. Like, just the way in which we all do business together was so radically different back then that we found that there were gaps in what that agreement talked about, or there were rules that were just too cumbersome for today's world. So fixing those was part of the modernization. The other thing is that it didn't include things that our citizens, our societies, believe are important when it comes to looking at trade today. For example, environmental protection, labor standards. It had rules around the labor standards, but they were in a side agreement, and there was no sort of bindingness to them. We now have chapters on that require high labor standards. We have chapters that require a certain amount of environmental stewardship that are a part of the agreement. And so you can't get the benefits of free trade as between our three countries unless you are willing to also put in place standards that are relevant for those issues that are important to Canadians and Americans and Mexicans. So that's some of the ways in which we modernized it.
Gotcha, yeah. We just recently, I think within the last week, saw news that the Pope had apologized to Indigenous peoples for their treatment at church-run schools. Canada has had its truth and reconciliation discussions, and I don't think that we're quite to that point in the United States yet, but it seems like it's coming. And so I know I'm throwing a lot of different questions at you, but I wonder what you think about that and whether there are lessons that the United States can learn from Canada in terms of how it had treated its Indigenous peoples and going forward, too, and how it treats its Indigenous people.
Just before coming to talk to you, I was with our Premier of Nunavut, who is an Indigenous Canadian, Inuit Canadian, and our Premier of the Northwest Territories, who's a Métis, also Indigenous Canadian. And they both referenced this apology by the Pope and saying that it was a really important step. It's not the end of the path towards reconciliation. And the Pope has said that he will come to Canada and meet with Canadian Indigenous populations and citizens and survivors of the residential schools. And I think that that's really impactful. So I think that just having the courage to walk that path and to keep walking it is very important. You know, our Prime Minister has said, he said before he was elected, that there is no more important relationship for Canada than its relationship with its Indigenous populations. And he's reaffirmed that several times. I think most recently, something that I think is really important is that the government took an approach towards developing its policy for the North and the Indigenous population within the North in particular. Developed that policy in a very new and unique way. There have been many, I don't think there's probably a single Canadian government that hasn't sought to develop policies to bridge the gap between the services and the amenities and the infrastructure and the education and the healthcare available in the North versus the South, right? That gap is real and has been with us for a while. And I think all Canadian governments come in with a sincere effort to try and address that, but it hasn't yet proven to be as successful as it should be. And what our government did back in 2016 is they set up a process by which deciding the policies that we needed to put in place to bridge those gaps would be developed in concert with, together with our Indigenous populations, our Northern Territories, and some of our provinces that are Northern provinces. And it took a long time. It wasn't easy. And probably what's come out isn't, it's not everyone agrees with everything in it, but it was a very significant shift so that the decisions, the policies, the priorities, the vision is co-led by the populations of the North. And I've heard from many people of Canada's Arctic and Northern Territories that it was a really important change. It's a lot of work to do, but it was a really important change.
Well, so again, from your bio, I noticed that you're the first woman Canadian ambassador to the United States. And I know this is fairly broad, but what's that like? How has that been?
Well, it's great. I love my job. I can barely express how honored and privileged I feel to be representing my country with our closest friend, neighbor, ally, partner. I mean, the Canada-US relationship is central to virtually everything that we do. And so it is a true honor and privilege. So I love that. From the perspective of being the first woman, I have been the first woman actually in a lot of jobs that I did. So I was the first woman Canadian who led a major trade negotiation. I was the first Canadian woman to be at the head of the trade agency of our government. I've often been the only woman at a table. So I'm not that I'm used to. But this is a much more public-facing job. You know, I have a much more public role. And that has led me to think a little bit more about what me in this position might mean to other people. And that's not something I had spent as much time thinking about before. So I take that quite seriously. And I don't think it's just women, actually. If me being in this job allows some people who maybe hadn't thought that they had a chance to do certain kinds of careers, whether they're a woman or whether they're, you know, coming from a visible minority population or another marginalized population or an LGBTQ population, and they don't see themselves in certain kinds of professions. If me being in this profession as the first person doing it allows them to think, hey, wait, if I have the skills and experience and abilities, I have a chance at that job too, then I will be very happy. And I do try and say that. The other thing I try and do is not just sort of, you know, lead by doing, but to actually try and open the door consciously for people who maybe haven't had opportunities in certain domains. So to consciously think about, are we, not just me, but my whole team, are we doing as much as we can to not only open the door to those people, but like to pull out the chair and, you know, have them sit down and make sure they're part of the conversation. And I think that takes a little bit, it takes conscious effort. You actually have to think a little bit about your biases and then consciously try to include people who haven't been included in certain kinds of jobs and professions and conversations before. And it's great. And I'm honored to be able to do it. And I'm happy to be able to think about it because people like you ask me this question and it makes me think about it a lot.
It seems like the kind of thing that you probably have come to realize as you've inhabited the role to know that that's the role that you're in, that, you know, that you would do that kind of work.
Yeah.
Speaking of the work, I wondered, I know you had come in as the ambassador, your appointment came in 2020, and of course the pandemic came shortly thereafter. And so maybe it's hard to compare to too much before that, but did the pandemic make your job much more difficult, do you think?
So before I was formally appointed, I was acting as ambassador for 9 months. So I think back to those 9 months with, you know, a bit of nostalgia, because that was what is actually now starting to happen again. That was the full role of ambassador, which is I did travel around a bit. I did do a lot of in-person convening, right, of whether it's a panel or a roundtable or a dinner or whatever, bringing people together, Canadians and Americans, whether it's government or private sector, you know, that's a big part of the job, is to bring people together to reinforce the relationship, as well as doing the policy work, which is, you know, dealing with, I don't know, some kind of infrastructure challenge, or there's a flood, or there's something between the two countries that you have to be thinking about and trying to solve. And then, of course, the pandemic came. I was appointed at the end of March. So really just as we were all shutting down. In fact, I was appointed 2 days after we shut our embassy to in-person work. Mm. And everything was different, right? Everything was different. And what was really different about the diplomatic role was there was a lot of work to do. Right. We, as Alaskans well know, Canada and the U.S. Restricted travel on the border significantly. And it's the longest land border in the world. Right. We have over 500,000 people crossing that border in normal times every single day. We have 70,000 transport vehicles every single day. And that's an enormous feat. So that took a lot of energy, complicated. You know, many, many people had to be involved, different regions of the country with different particularities, again, as Alaskans know well. And we didn't know what was going on with COVID. Remember? I mean, remember those early days? We were struggling for PPE. We didn't know if there'd be a vaccine. We didn't know if it'd be short-lived, it'd be long-lived. People were afraid. So there was a lot of work to be done with our scientists, with our regulators, with our trying to procure equipment. Our militaries worked very closely together because we had, as did you, remote hospitals or pop-up hospitals, and our militaries were involved in that. So we had military cooperation, which was really vital and, frankly, a wonderful thing to see. So there's all these ways in which we were all really, really busy. But there were no dinner parties, I can tell you that. There were no convenings of roundtables where people were talking about the future of our relationship and how they can do more business together, or what, you know, cultural cooperation, or all of these other rich parts of the job. Eventually we started to do some of that online, as everyone did, and that was nice. And I think we succeeded in doing some of that very, very well. But it was a different kind, just as was for everyone, right? It was just a different kind of time.
Yeah, I imagine, like with journalism, there's a lot of learning about the world and maybe diplomacy that goes on at like dinner parties and things like that that you just wouldn't be able to do. But I didn't realize you had been an acting ambassador for 9 months. So you did get a taste of that before.
I did. And now it's back.
Hopefully things are coming back.
Yeah, it really is. So as I say, this is my first trip, really. This is just Alaska is my first trip out in the region since the end of COVID. And it's great. And there will be more. I think this is really important for me, to be out and about and meeting people. You really do learn about the United States outside of Washington. And I say that with the greatest, you know, respect and affection. It's the same thing in Canada. There's what happens in our capital, but if you really want to understand the richness of a country, you need to go to the different regions and talk to people and see what's important to them. So I'm really thrilled. We have 12 offices across the country, and they've been doing a terrific job. We have 12 consuls general. They're doing a wonderful job. But it's my responsibility to participate in that as well. And so I'm super excited about getting to start with that.
Yeah, it's very cool that you're here, I mean, to come visit our state. And I think maybe just the last thing I wanted to ask you, at the Arctic Encounters, speaking of meeting people here and being on the ground here in Alaska, what do people come up and talk to you about? I mean, I tried to imagine, you know, different subject areas to talk to you about, but what is it that people, you know, questions that people hit you with?
Okay, so without fail, whether it's here in Alaska or anywhere that I travel in the United States, without fail, the number one thing that people say to me is a version of this. I love Canada, and I have a fill-in-the-blank daughter-in-law from Canada, son who studied in Canada, business partner in Canada, fishing cabin in Canada, my wife's and I honeymooned in Canada. There is always a connection. So it's a two-parter. It's always, lovely to meet you, I love Canada, and then a very clear personal connection to Canada, almost without exception, everyone I meet, which I can't tell you how happy that makes me, because I believe and know for a fact that the strength of the Canada-US relationship, of course, it's enhanced by the fact that Prime Minister Trudeau and President Biden like each other, they have similar policies, trying to do stuff together. That is wonderful. You know, our premiers and our state governors try and do stuff together. Our businesses do stuff together. That's wonderful. But the strength of the Canada-US relationship is built on that. It's built on people who feel an affinity for each other, who interact with each other in millions of ways all the time, every day, and are committed to making sure that that relationship continues in a positive, healthy, friendly, peaceful way. I would just like to say to you and to everyone in Alaska and in the United States, my goodness, we should never take that for granted, ever. We are so lucky to have each other as neighbors. We could not be luckier, because we're committed to each other's success, right? And let's be honest, we're seeing in graphic terms these days how that is not true for many, many countries around this world. And so lucky us.
Well, on behalf of all of Alaska, likewise, and thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, Casey.